Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-11-697, Santiago v. Tanaka. Arguing for the petitioner, Frederick J. Arsenmeyer. Arguing for the respondent, Robert Goldberg. Argument of the merits.
All right. Good morning, counsel. Are you both ready to proceed? All right. And, Mr. Arsenmeyer, we will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go, and Mr. Goldberg will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go as well. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Fred Arnsmeyer. I represent the petitioners in this matter, Luis Santiago and Young Han Santiago. Your Honors, this case, for argument's sake, essentially consists of two parts. The purchase transaction of the Willy Willy Tavern and the plaintiff's, the petitioner's claims for non-disclosure and misrepresentation, as well as the retaliatory non-judicial foreclosure. I'd like to address each of those separately, but I'd like to start first with the non-judicial foreclosure. As an initial point, as pointed out in our petition and in our briefing, we've maintained all along that the mortgage at issue in this case, in fact, didn't contain a legal power of sale, which would have allowed the respondent to exercise the authority under Section 6675 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes to conduct a private auction without judicial oversight.
Now, assuming that to be true, what relief would you request then?
The relief that we would request is that the court hold the sale void, as this court held in Lee versus HSBC Bank, where a mortgagee fails to strictly comply with that statutory process. This court has held that the resulting sale of the property is void.
Are you saying that your client wants the property back and to operate the business again?
Absolutely. Or in the alternative, my client believes he is entitled to damages.
I thought you argued specifically that you did not want rescission, that you wanted restitution.
We argued a number of different things in the alternative. In the event that my clients were to lose the property, then we wanted damages.
But the Tanakas have sold the property, correct?
Well, I understand that they claim that they've sold it.
And so how would you see you receiving the relief of having the property, having title reside in your client?
Well, there's a question as to whether the buyer in this alleged sale was actually a bona fide purchaser for value. Only a bona fide purchaser for value, someone who pays good.
Is the deed in evidence? Because we've had, cases where there have been sales after non-judicial foreclosure. It's a quit claim deed that says, basically it's a quit claim deed, and whatever title we have, you get, and you're subject to anything that through the non-judicial foreclosure. But is the deed in this case in evidence? Is it a part of the record?
The subsequent deed,
yes.
Tanaka's sale to a third
right.
party?
The sale to the third party. Is that deed in evidence?
That is not in evidence.
Okay.
Well, it's maybe you want to clarify. It wasn't in evidence in the lower court, but subsequently the other side filed a motion and attached as an exhibit the deed. Now, that has never been, I don't think there's been judicial notice, but there is something in the appellate record. There's a document.
That's right, Your Honor. And that's why in the petition we maintained that it was inappropriate for the ICA to consider that deed. As it fell outside the record, the ICA's consideration of the evidence in that motion actually violated Section 641-2 of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. Additionally, I would point out that a similar situation happened before this court in the case of Lothrop versus Sakatani. In that case, there was, in fact, evidence in the record of a sale. However, the petitioner, only on appeal, sought to claim that sale was a sham transaction. And as pointed out in footnote 9 of that opinion, this court indicated that it couldn't consider matters that were attached to the reply brief in support of that argument because they didn't appear in the record.
Let me go back to the question about whether there is a power of nonjudicial foreclosure. There's language in the agreement in the mortgage that says the mortgagee may, with or without taking possession, foreclose this mortgage by court proceeding, and then there's some provisions that I don't think are relevant here, or, as now or then provided by law, by advertisement and sale of the mortgage property or any parts or parts thereof at a public auction in the county in which the mortgage property are situated. Why is that latter language not a power of sale?
Our position in this case is the first part of that phrase, as now or then provided by law. The Ninth Circuit recognized in the case of Appel versus Bank of New York that Hawaii law does not provide the power of sale. It simply acknowledges the availability of that process if the power of sale is contained in the mortgage. This mortgage appeared to allow a power of sale foreclosure if the power of sale was now or then provided by law.
So if it didn't allow it, that would be non-judicial foreclosure. So wouldn't the mortgage still be alive, but they could only foreclose it under a judicial foreclosure?
That's correct. Okay. Without a power of sale, a mortgagee is required to file a complaint in a court.
And as Justice Nakayama just said, it actually says in it, by court proceeding, or as now or then. So it had the option already to allow for court proceeding, or alternatively, if it had been created within, if the law had specifically outlawed. So there was already an alternative in this.
That's right. If the power was provided by the statute, and in fact, in some states, in some circumstances, a power of sale is provided by statute.
Well, isn't there another reading that as now or then provided by law could simply provide that if there are restrictions in the applicable law as to how the sale is supposed to take place, those restrictions would apply, but nevertheless, in other words, we're trying to understand the intent of the parties to this agreement, and can it not be read to suggest that they have in fact conferred that power, but subject to whatever requirements might exist in the law?
Well, it's very difficult to ascertain the intent of the parties from this. Essentially, it's an adhesion contract drafted by the mortgagee. This language is buried in paragraphs. It's actually the longest run-on sentence I've ever seen. And it doesn't comply. We offered in the record below examples of standard mortgages that contain a power of sale, and that power typically requires traditional words of granting a power. Specifically, I hereby grant to mortgagee with power of sale. No such language of grant was contained in this mortgage.
Mr. Ehrensmeyer, the Intermediate Court of Appeals indicated that findings of fact 6 through 9 and 12 through 14 were not challenged. So they didn't address those particular, I guess, your arguments regarding this. What is your response?
Your Honor, clearly those arguments, those findings were challenged. I understand the ICA pointed out what, in my opinion, was a clerical mistake in the style that the brief was drafted, but those issues were clearly raised in the appeal. For the most part, the ICA even stated, regardless, we're going to go ahead and try to address this case on the merits, but then they went on to skip over what, in my opinion, were two of the most important issues in the case. And if I could, I'd like to move on to my second point, and that's about the right to cure. This is a foreclosure that happened on a mortgage and a note that was fully paid. In this case, in March of 2008, my client admittedly withheld a payment, put it in a separate account. Opposing counsel on behalf of his client immediately noticed a nonjudicial foreclosure.
Your client came current, right?
Like my client came current.
So basically we have one late payment, is that right?
That's right.
And then your client lost $1.4 million.
Correct.
One late payment.
That's right. And in fact, I'd like to point to believe it's Exhibit 6, Defendant's Exhibit 6. It was a letter on April 3rd of 2008 in which defendant, through counsel, stated, please bring your account current if you want to participate in mediation.
And this was based on non-payment of a sewer charge that was not disclosed during the sale. The agreement was there, but the disclosure said it was $150 for sewer, and in closing, there was no proration for the Jasper sewer charges.
None. That's correct. But backing up, I'd like to emphasize that there was that offer made through counsel to bring the account current, and the account subsequently was brought current.
Sir, do you think that by offering mediation, there was impliedly that they wouldn't be going through disclosure proceedings?
Well, a note is either accelerated or it's not. If it's brought current, it's not accelerated. If it's not accelerated, one can't foreclose a mortgage.
This is really an aside, but I'm just really curious. Why was your first complaint dismissed?
Your Honor, I understand the prior lawsuit, different counsel handled that. It was dismissed. The judge ordered the case to mediation.
So dismissed for mediation?
Yes.
Well, what's the authority for that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. But that's what I understand happened. My firm didn't get involved until later after the second lawsuit was filed. I'd like to also suggest that the fact that not only was the missed payment cured, but every monthly payment after was made through trial, and even after trial, until judgment was entered. Every single monthly payment, every single one of those payments was accepted. And I have authority from Oregon. It's Alderman versus Davidson, 954P2D779. It's the Oregon Supreme Court in 1997, holding that acceptance of late installment payments towards a promissory note is a waiver of the right to accelerate and foreclose. And we believe in this case that act of acceptance was a waiver. That no judicial foreclosure could have been conducted after that loan was essentially cured and then paid in full.
Tanaka's argued that there's no right to cure under the statute, under the agreement. What's your response to that?
We would suggest it's a matter of equity. The statute certainly recognizes a right to cure. 2008, just a couple of months after this foreclosure was first noticed. In fact, the legislature in Hawaii passed an amendment to 6675, specifically requiring an attorney to represent a mortgagee who would be available upon request to provide the right, the amount, in order for a mortgagee to cure any default.
What would be the reason that one would have to provide the amount to cure the default if you didn't have the right to cure it? I mean, why would the legislature specifically provide the amount to cure the default if there's no right to cure?
Perhaps the legislature believes that the right is implied, similar to, you know, in the cases of agreements of sale where there's this question of equity.
Could you please turn that phone off? I'm sorry. Thank you.
If someone brings a note current under an agreement of sale, this court and Hawaii courts have routinely held that then it becomes a question of equity. What's fair? Is the seller entitled to keep everything, or are they only entitled to keep up to an amount equivalent to their actual damages? And our courts have routinely held an injured seller, as a matter of equity, is only allowed to retain an amount up to what's necessary to make them whole. But in this case, the seller, the mortgagee, was made whole.
Well, what's your response to the Intermediate Court of Appeals' suggestion that this argument was somehow waived by not having been raised until the reconsideration motion?
With respect to the forfeiture, Your Honor.
Correct.
Your Honor, we maintained all along that it would be inequitable for Santiago's not only to lose the property, but for damages to be awarded against them. We may not have phrased it in the context of Jenkins versus Wise and that line of cases. Honestly, I didn't anticipate this absurd of a result in the trial court, and it was only after we did our opening statement, pre-trial findings of fact, conclusion of law, presented a week-long trial, closing arguments, only after receiving the court's final decision did we realize, wow, this is unjust. And certainly, you know, when you look at Hawaii case law, the trial court's decision simply didn't match up. It was unfair, it was inequitable, and one of the reasons for reconsideration, as we pointed out in our opening brief, is to correct manifest injustice. A court always has the authority to go back and modify its decisions in the interest of justice.
Here to correct manifest error on whether or not there was a right to cure and whether or not whether there was a provision to power of sale in the agreement.
Certainly.
Again, I'm a little bit concerned. What is the remedy that you're requesting? You're requesting a remand and rescission?
Well, we'll start with remand.
Remand for what?
Well, for further proceedings. There's a question about whether this sale of the property is final or not. If this buyer, in fact, was not a bona fide purchaser for value, the title to the property, possession of the property, are still issues that can be further pursued. In the event that the court were to determine that those matters can't be, which we think would be legally inappropriate, certainly we'd be pursuing the issue of damages or offset or, you know, returning that equity that Santiago's were deprived of in this case. At the very least, I guess what's most absurd out of this whole situation, after everything they lost, the circuit court went ahead and entered another $152,000 in attorney's fees and costs, which they're now liable for. The plaintiffs in the case are making efforts to collect on that. The Santiago's have been completely put out of business. And
the plaintiff, I'm nice. Sorry, the Tanaka, was it? The seller received $1.4 million from you. Paid 300-something thousand at the non-judicial foreclosure, allegedly sold it for 800,000, right?
Actually, she didn't pay anything at the non-judicial foreclosure. It was a credit.
Credit bid, but received another 800,000, allegedly received another 800,000 from somebody else.
Right, so it was a double recovery. We think it's
2.2 million.
But again, that question of whether that subsequent sale can be set aside, that's not an issue that is properly before the court. It wasn't an issue that was properly before the ICA. It was never litigated in the record. That's a question for the future.
That you would agree that purchaser, whoever it is, assuming there is a separate purchaser, would be an indispensable party to any further proceedings in this case.
Further proceedings would certainly... at least if my clients choose to pursue their claims to title, would probably require an amended complaint bringing in that third party. But that process certainly is available.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, can you talk a bit about your client's claims regarding the adequacy of disclosures during the sale transaction?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess... to get to the heart of this question, what we're maintaining wasn't disclosed here. It's not the fact that the sewer agreement wasn't disclosed. It's not the fact that the place was hooked up to a private sewer that wasn't disclosed. What wasn't disclosed was this arrangement whereby this extreme sewer fee, it was $1,160 per month and then another bi-monthly clean-out charge of the same amount, essentially 20 grand a year.
And an accelerated 20%
sewer fees. Exactly. In the first 10 years of owning the property, the Santiago's would have had to pay over $500,000 in sewer fees.
But not only was it not disclosed, it was represented that the sewer fee was $150 a month, was it not?
Well, that's the number that came out in the disclosures, and there was never anything provided to correct that. And as we pointed out, the Santiagos had operated the property for 10 years, and they always paid sewer fees. They had no reason to believe that a separate sewer fee was required.
Who were you paying the sewer fee to?
The sewer fee went to the county. And I understand that this sewer system was built at the direction of the county. And pursuant to the agreement itself, the sewer system was intended to be dedicated to the county. Our clients had no reason to question who they should be paying sewer fees to. They just knew that they always paid sewer fees, and the figure of $150, it really didn't bother them at all. But had they known that in the first 10 years they were either going to have to build a new sewer pumping station or pay $500,000 for sewer services, those are certainly material issues that would have affected their decision on how much, if anything, to pay for this property.
Well, now, in terms of your analysis, I know that you're focusing on the question about whether a reasonable person would believe that there would be an effect on the value that would be a measurable value in looking at the DROA. But in looking at the information that was disclosed at $150 a month, and you compare that to what was actually being paid, which is significant, looked like it was $1,500 a month for sewer maintenance plus $1,153 every 2 months for clean out. Your client was managing this property for a number of years, correct?
That's correct.
And so I think the argument that is being presented by the Tanakas is that really, I mean, there was no common sense that should be expected to understand that there is this significant fee that's being paid in the course of business as an operating cost. There's no common sense understanding that they should have realized that there was an additional cost that was that significant. They shouldn't have inquired into it, particularly when they got the wastewater agreement.
No, Your Honor, because again, they were always paying sewer fees. They had no reason to think that there was this separate arrangement.
Under your lease agreement for 7 years, I understand it was your obligation to pay all utility charges.
That's correct.
And sewer is a utility.
Yes.
And you never paid this for the 7 years.
Never.
So why would you suspect that there was this additional $2,600 a month charge?
Our clients had no reason to. And in fact, the owner of the sewer never came by the property once during that period of time where they ran the lease. When Jay Geffert testified as a witness below, he said that Jasper never came by. He never came by to require somebody to clean out the grease trap. In fact, my clients, they did all of that. It was only after the fact that Jasper came by and said, you know, you're bound under this wastewater agreement. You need to have somebody come in here every month and clean out this grease trap, and you also need to pay me these fees. That never happened in the 10 years the Santiagos leased the property.
Mr. Arnsmeyer, the Tanakas claim that the Santiagos are experienced business people, and they utilized a very experienced commercial real estate salesperson to assist them. And once they were on notice that there was a separate sewage agreement, they needed to exercise due diligence to look into the matter with Jasper or whoever. What is your response to that?
Well, there's certainly a duty of due diligence. Perhaps it's slightly heightened in the sense of commercial property, but there's a limit to it as well. Certainly had this fee been disclosed or the fact that the Santiagos would have to negotiate for sewer service in order to operate the property, certainly that would have triggered a duty to go follow up with Jasper and say, hey, what's going on with this sewer? If I buy this property, am I going to be able to operate? But I think most reasonable business people assume that when they buy a restaurant, that restaurant is going to be, you know, functioning. It's going to be attached to a sewer system, and that sewer system is going to be available and operating.
Didn't Takasi say, look, we looked at the documentation they provided us, and what they provided us, there was no indication of this extraordinary sewer cost.
That's correct.
And Takasi, and I think if I remember, the testimony was this was the single greatest operating cost of the restaurant, and it wasn't disclosed.
It was the record. Actually, we presented at trial the Kubuyama Hotel accounting records, and they showed that for all those years when the property was being leased to the Santiagos, this sewer fee was paid, and you know, by those later years it was so high, it was the single largest expense for owning that property. It wasn't disclosed. You know, in the context of real estate, when somebody buys a property, certain things are routinely disclosed. Maintenance fees, electricity, utilities, that stuff is routinely disclosed. And in this case,
not only was it not disclosed, but there was a representation that it was $150.
Right. And then there was nothing to correct that misrepresentation. At that point, any reasonable person, knowing that that was the single highest operating charge for the property, when they provided that information, certainly they had a duty to disclose that, a duty to disclose, hey, there's a problem with the sewer service. When that issue, that problem was disclosed, then that duty of diligence would have shifted to the Santiago's.
And there was a duty to forward it to escrow if this was clearly a pro rata, something that was supposed to be paid by the buyer.
Absolutely. And that, you know, that just goes to show even further, because at closing, I believe the contract provided a mechanism for where things weren't disclosed or prorated, assessments weren't prorated. That would trigger another option to cancel the contract. But these fees weren't prorated for the 15 days in August at closing. So even at that point, where notice at the last minute could have potentially been given, that wasn't done either. It wasn't until months after the property that this issue came to the Santiago.
All right, now let me be clear about your concept of due diligence. Once your client is alerted to this wastewater agreement, because the wastewater agreement does include some information that was probably new since the negotiation of the DROA, correct?
Perhaps.
Such as the right to adjust the deposit annually in a sum not exceeding 20%. I don't think you were aware of that, correct?
Probably not.
But in any case, you became aware that there was a wastewater agreement. So to what extent would you suggest, due diligence would suggest, you call up Mr. Jasper to find out what it's about?
Again, due diligence, in my opinion, wouldn't kick in until there was that disclosure that, hey, there's a contract, but you're not going to be a party to it if you buy this property. You need to look for sewer service. Right now, we're going through Jasper. At that point, that duty of diligence would have kicked in.
In other words, the mere fact that you found out that there is this separate agreement would not require due diligence to find out what the provisions of it are beyond what it stated.
The disclosure of that agreement alone, it wasn't enough. And perhaps, you know, a reading of that document, a reasonable person would, you know, have every reason to assume that it's historical, especially given the context that it was provided in. It was 10 years old. It had to do with a building, a sewer system at the direction of the county to be committed to the county. And given the practice over those 10 years of the Santiago's always making monthly sewer payments, it simply wasn't a concern. $150 months under an old wastewater agreement didn't affect their decision whether or not to buy or the price at which they would buy the property.
Mr. Arensmeyer, let's reserve some of your time for rebuttal. We'll move on to hear from Mr. Goldberg.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Rob Goldberg for Ruth Tanaka. Her husband, Harold Tanaka, is present in the courtroom today. Let me begin with a brief chronology of what we think the reason we're here today is because of bad decisions and unwise choices by the Santiagos, not by Mrs. Tanaka. First, in the purchase of...
let's be clear. It's not really Mrs. Tanaka, right? You actually had an agent handling everything. Right, your client actually had an agent.
Ms. Tanaka was represented by a real estate broker, Mr. Richardson, yes.
Okay.
My client is Mrs. Tanaka.
Right. So did she actually do the disclosure herself?
The disclosure was filled out by her husband and or her father-in-law, who signed it. But she has certainly participated in that with her property matter.
So why wasn't the sewer disclosed in the disclosures?
Let me tackle the disclosure head on then.
Why was it represented that it was $150 is my really real question.
Sure. There's two different things, Justice McKenna. There's the county sewer fees that are paid to the county of Kauai. Those are $150. There's a private sewer agreement with the Jasper development next door, Anchor Cove. It's a private sewer agreement between Jasper and Tanaka. That private sewer agreement was not binding on the Santiagos. It did not run with the land. It was not a lien or encumbrance on the property. It was not recorded. It was not, the Santiagos did not owe a penny under that agreement. The Santiagos were free to make any sewer arrangements they like. They could continue with that agreement with Jasper, and that was okay with Jasper. They could negotiate a new agreement with Jasper, and that was okay with Jasper, and that's what happened. They negotiated a new agreement for $500 a month flat, plus GET, much more favorable than Mrs. Tanaka ever had with the Jaspers. That was their agreement with Jaspers. Or they can not use the Jasper sewer system. They can make their own arrangements, build their own system, do a county system. They can do whatever they want. But
I'm sorry, you just referenced this $500. What is this about?
Santiago and Jasper made a new agreement to use the Jasper private sewer system for $500 a month. That was the testimony of Jasper and others at trial. And the reason that's so significant is we said all along...
That was way, way after the bills started coming. Isn't that correct?
The ultimate agreement, but it could have been agreed on any time. Could have been negotiated at any time. They could have started negotiating that on day one. That was up to them. But the point is...
When you say it's up to them, either they reach agreement with Jasper, they pay the amount, or they have to build their own wastewater, sewage.
I suppose there are other options if they want to work off some sort of county system as well.
That's what your witness said.
Yeah, but the point is, there's a private agreement between Tanaka and Jasper. So it's not binding on Santiago.
So your position was, as I remember, and the judge's was, there was no need even to disclose it.
I agree that it was not required to be disclosed, but we don't need to address
because that. Because it's not a part of the real estate? Is that what you're suggesting?
No, because the Santiagos had no obligations under that agreement at all.
So they would have no sewer then?
They can make any arrangements they want for sewer.
You don't have to disclose that if you don't make a private separate arrangement, you're not going to have a sewer system?
I don't know that that's a fact. What they did disclose.
You're selling a tavern. How can you operate a tavern without a sewer system?
Oh, I don't think you can. But the seller's disclosure form, which is the exactly correct, appropriate place to provide the formal disclosure, has a place on page 3, number 77, that asks about sewer disclosure. That's where you make the disclosure. And there's a box to check off for public sewer, it's not checked. There's a box to check off for private sewer, it's checked. There's a box to check off for connected, question mark, it's checked.
Is that the same document where it was represented that it was $150?
No.
Okay, this is a different document.
It's the seller's disclosure document. It's Exhibit G41.
But
I'm
sorry, you can complete your answer.
And on page 4 of the seller's disclosure, where there's a section to provide additional information, which is not required, they went ahead and provided additional information with respect to number 77 and said, it is a private sewer owned by Anchor Cove. We are connected. And to the left of that number 77 is the handwritten notation, check on number 7, this disclosure number 77. The testimony by Mr. Takase, the buyers, the Santiago's broker, was sitting at Mr. Santiago's kitchen table in Hilo. They went over the disclosures. He wrote down, check on this private sewer system. You need to look into this. You need to investigate this. And they didn't. There was full disclosure,
he
Justice.
He actually testified that they looked at the documentation. He said that at least 3 different times in his testimony, saying that was check on. They saw it, and then they looked at the documentation that they were provided. After they looked at the documentation, which said $150, that satisfied what they were concerned with.
Mr. Goldberg, doesn't this beg the question, though? I mean, regardless of what note-taking was made during the course of negotiations, isn't there a standard that's applied from the point of view of a reasonable person, whether a reasonable person would believe that this fact would measurably affect the value? And the fact we're talking about is the fact that, you know, Justice McKenna's focused on the fact of this additional operating cost. So isn't this just begging the question about whether there was a duty to disclose what was the arguably the highest operating cost, even if there is a statement that on the DROA there's a box that says that there is a private sewage system?
That's in the seller's disclosure, Justice.
Seller's disclosure. And even if the seller's disclosure identifies a certain sewage fee of $150. Even so, isn't the question begged, shouldn't there be more of a disclosure if it's the highest operating cost that's involved in the property?
I don't know that's the highest operating cost, but to answer the question directly, they provided tons of disclosure on this. They provided the actual wastewater agreement that provides the 20% escalations in both paragraphs 5 and 7 for the monthly
Tons of disclosure, was there any disclosure about this private fee that was in 10 times the cost of the $150 a month?
If you're asking me, did they provide a copy of the most recent invoice? No, they didn't. But did they provide the actual wastewater agreement and the whole history of the private sewer system? They provided tons of stuff. And here's one
more. But why wouldn't, applying this reasonable person standard, why wouldn't you say reasonable person would believe that that would measurably affect the value of the tavern? That is, how much is being paid to make the business operate through the private sewage system?
And that's why it was disclosed, even though it arguably didn't need to be disclosed.
It was disclosed in what fashion?
On the seller's disclosure form and providing the wastewater agreement and all the other disclosure documents.
But none of those disclosures actually said how much it was costing for the private system.
But actually, all the testimony trial, every single witness testified that the 20% escalation applied separately to the monthly maintenance charges and the bi-monthly cleanup.
Actually, except no, the document, it's deposit, right?
Right, the wastewater agreement doesn't say that.
I think it does, and let me explain why. First of all, and by the way, everything I'm saying is consistent with what...
No, please do, because the wastewater agreement so far seems to... The adjustment seems to apply to the...
Deposit,
yeah.
First point is that the 20% escalation is referenced in both separately in paragraph 5 on the monthly maintenance charges and paragraph 7 on the bi-monthly cleanup.
It says the deposit can be increased, not the charge.
But it's also not referenced in paragraph 8, which provides for the deposit. So you also have to ask the question, is that a reasonable construction? It is mentioned in the separately in the charges.
Okay, so talk about reasonable construction.
Yeah.
How about the fact that the Santiago's leased these premises before purchasing it for 7 years, that under the lease they were responsible for all utilities, that they never, ever were presented with a Jasper bill?
First, the lease isn't in evidence in this case. I understand what you're saying. That's an argument that's been made, but the lease is not in evidence.
This was not argued at trial?
There's testimony about it, but the lease itself is not in evidence. But second, this is a payment that was made by Tanaka to Jasper. It wasn't a payment that was being made by Santiago, and Tanaka wasn't asking Santiago to make this payment. I mean, it's almost as if Mrs. Tanaka is being faulted for making payments.
Oh, so then Ms. Tanaka was willing to continue making this payment without, after the sale?
I'm sorry, Justice?
I thought that Ms. Tanaka was, the Tanakas were billed, and then she said, forget it, send it to the Santiagos.
She no longer owned the tavern. Now, what happens at that point is entirely up to the new buyers, what arrangements they want to make, and they did make new arrangements. And that proves that they could have made their own arrangements at a much cheaper cost than Tanaka was paying all these years.
Well, it certainly does.
But your argument is, oh, well, here you get this bill that's 10 times greater than what you thought, and so what? You're on your own. You can do what you can. Maybe you'll be able to make an agreement. Maybe you won't be. Maybe you'll have to build your own wastewater. The question is that something significant that should have been disclosed to the buyer?
And I'm continuing to maintain that it was disclosed, Justice Bob. But also, let me point out, let's shift to due diligence. Mr. Santiago testified at trial.
We don't get to due diligence until you satisfy your duty to disclose.
Sure, and you provide the wastewater agreement, and you make the disclosure that there's a private sewer system that's connected to the tavern, and then he has a broker who goes over with him and says you need to investigate this.
Go ahead.
The most significant part of the agreement was the cost, and you never disclose the cost. It seems somewhat deliberate. When you know that it's the high, well, maybe she may not have known that it was the highest operating, but it's a significant amount with this huge escalation clause. And you say you disclosed everything, but the most significant thing wasn't disclosed.
But when you say never disclosed, the 20% escalation is in there separately for both charges.
Talk about the price.
That's exactly what we're talking about. It was escalated 20% every year, which resulted in the $1,100 a month. That's how you got to $1,100 a month. because Jasper escalated 20% a year. That wasn't us. That was Jasper. And we paid it every year.
Uh-huh. And why wasn't that disclosed, I guess is what I'm asking.
The 20% escalation is in the document.
Why isn't the amount that was paid disclosed?
Because
when you say you disclosed everything, you disclosed everything, apparently, except the price. Why was that not?
But it's just like the price. We're selling real estate. It's not a business purchase agreement. And we're not asked to disclose all the costs of running the business. We didn't disclose our insurance payments or our management fees. There's a million costs of business that weren't disclosed. I mean, internet, water, cable, ice, food, beverage, labor, whatever.
We didn't disclose the single biggest operating expense, which very well might, and according to the testimony, they would not have gone through with the agreement.
I can't agree with you, Justice, because the 20% escalation is in the document. And, I mean, let's point out, this isn't just Rob Goldberg making this stuff up. After a full-on trial and 3 years litigation, the circuit court found in our favor with 56 findings of fact and 53 exclusions of law, and a unanimous ICA affirmed. So it's not like I'm just making this stuff up out of thin air.
Well, could I ask for your assistance in explaining the ICA's findings of fact? Because, the circuit court's findings of fact and the ICA's focus on due diligence. Now, what does the due diligence mean in this case that you're anticipating? In other words, the due diligence that you perceive is that at the point when should they have investigated, or wasn't it necessary to investigate? That's what I'm interested in. Was it when they got the wastewater agreement? Was it when the DRA was being negotiated? When, from your point of view, did due diligence require investigation, if at all?
The DRA provides three periods for that kind of due diligence. First, as soon as they got the disclosures, they had a 5-day period to rescind. And I want to point out that 5-day period was at the insistence of the buyers. Normally in commercial property, it's longer. This was the testimony of Mr. Richardson. Normally it's 20 days or more. They insisted it be shrunk down to 5 days because they wanted it done fast. There's a second rescission right for subsequently discovered information for 3 days. Again, they wanted that number shorter. That wasn't our doing. That was the sign I was doing. And third, under paragraph C-51, there's a 30-day inspection period, automatic right to rescind, get any engineers, any professionals, any sewer engineers you want to investigate and find out, and you can get out of this contract automatically in 30 days. And Mr. Sanego testified at trial unambiguously that he did not look at the 95 pages of disclosure documents. He was not interested in spending time in disclosure because in his mind, the second he signed the counteroffer, it was a done deal and he wanted to close as soon as possible. He didn't want to spend time on disclosure.
This is not a normal transaction. They had leased it for 7 years. They knew the property. To them, it was almost theirs. It was, they had been operating it. But you say, in terms of these disclosures, and you say it was, we never gave the amounts for insurance, et cetera. Well, what about your counteroffer of January 16, 2006, where you say that the payment terms, and these are payments from the Santiagos to Ms. Tanaka, that the payment for sewer to her will be $150. It says $150. It says real property taxes are $300. Insurance is $226, et cetera. This is an affirmative representation that the sewer fee is $150. During the 7 years, they never paid Jasper. During the closing escrow, there's no proration. How does this comport with good faith and fair dealing?
First, I think you're referring to a counteroffer that wasn't accepted, that never became part of the contract.
It was presented.
I understand that.
In terms of the way people do business.
Second.
Is the buyer not entitled to rely on these numbers?
Not in this case, because you're talking about an agreement of sale that did not become part of the final deal, and that's an entirely different animal. Because when you're talking about an agreement of sale, you need to deal with issues that might cloud title because the sellers retain title. So then you need to deal with, just like when I paid Bank of Hawaii for my house, they pay for the taxes and insurance, and in this case, the payment to the county, if it's not paid, could result in a claim on title. So that's a county, that's a public sewer fee, that's not the private Jasper fee, and that's an agreement of sale situation which never happened.
Of course, it doesn't say that it's a public sewer. It doesn't say anything about public or private. It just says sewer, $150, which turns out to be the same amount.
But we're talking about the county sewer fee, which is the only type of fee that would result in a claim on title that you would include in an agreement of sale situation.
That's not what's here.
Let me just point out that there was an enormous amount of testimony and documents in front of the circuit court. And the circuit court found that disclosures were properly and timely made. Judge Watanabe issued all these findings of fact. So then the question becomes, remember, in terms of burdens, we were the defendant. They were the plaintiffs. It was their burden to prove non-disclosure. It wasn't our burden to prove disclosure, although I think we did. And the circuit court agreed that disclosure was made. She issued all the findings of fact. On appeal, they needed to demonstrate that those findings were clearly erroneous. They did not do that. The ICA went through their information, went through the numbers and the documents, and they affirmed. So it's not like we're looking at this thing on an absolutely clean slate. There's been an enormous amount of testimony and evidence considered.
If we find the findings to be clearly erroneous, let's turn to the non-judicial foreclosure part of it. How was equity done, assuming there was a power of sale?
Sure.
How is this equitable?
Okay, I hear exactly where you're coming from, so let me try to address it straight on. This is not a case, as has been characterized, as, gosh, just one mispayment and look at all these terrible things that happened. It's not like, you know, through inadvertence or accident or late mail or sickness or financial hardship, we just missed a payment and all, look what happened. Here's what really happened. What really happened is the first thing that happened is the Santiago sued Mrs. Tanaka for non-disclosure in the first case. To answer your question, we filed a motion to dismiss. Now, I was the counsel at the time. We filed a motion to dismiss for failure to engage in mediation as required under the purchase contract.
Okay.
There's a mandatory mediation provision.
All right.
That motion was granted. The next thing that happened is we're in mediation, or we're trying to work toward getting together in mediation. There's no litigation pending. And Mr. Santiago sends the handwritten, famous handwritten note, says, I am halting all payments due to litigation problems, exclamation point. And in fact, he does halt the payments, so it was not an idle threat. The payments were halted. And this was very significant to Mrs. Tanaka, and they were relying on this monthly income stream. Now, we look back today and say, oh, geez.
When did he become current?
Okay, never. The answer to that question is never, because he sent the letter, he stopped payments, and then Mrs. Tanaka, faced with the crisis, immediately did what she had every right to do. She noticed the default, she accelerated on the promissory note, and she initiated a non-judicial foreclosure. She had every right to do that. It's provided for in the mortgage document. It's provided for by statute. She did nothing wrong.
So, in other words, your position is when he handwrote this thing on March 10th because of his frustration with the litigation problems, puts the amount in a separate account, which is uncontested, the very next day, you folks say, send a default letter, accelerate, and that's it.
It's not quite it.
Well, it is it. That's been your position from the very beginning. There was no right to cure. It was it. It didn't matter how much he paid back or anything. That was it.
Pay off the note. And certainly, in terms of paying off the note, that's the cure. But he certainly has no right to unilaterally say, okay, no harm, no foul. Now I'll just go back to monthly payments. There's no right by statute. There's no right in the case law. No right to do that.
There is case law in this jurisdiction that foreclosure is an equitable remedy. What is equitable about what you are presenting here?
This case,
the next day, acceleration. Oh, sorry. What if they were just missed a payment for some other reason? You know, something happened and they missed a payment. Oh, sorry, we're going to accelerate. Your only remedy now is to pay off the $500,000. That's it. That's your only remedy. Otherwise, you're out the million that you already paid, right?
If it were that simple, I might agree with you, Justice, but there's more to the story.
Okay.
A couple months, 2 months later in May, they file a second lawsuit against us. So now Ms. Tanaka is embroiled in litigation. They threatened to stop the payments. They did stop the payments. And she's done what she's allowed to do. So he asked me a question, what is equity for her? How about equity for Mrs. Tanaka?
Wasn't a payment made after that?
A monthly payment was made, that's correct.
Payments were reinstated, right?
So when you say reinstated,
and I thought attorney's fees of about $14,000 were also paid.
Some attorney's fees were paid, but we've always maintained very clearly that the cure, if you like that word, was to pay off the note. That's what they had the right to do.
That's what you maintained. And so that's my question is, how is that equitable?
It's equitable. Oh, I'm sorry.
It was equitable for them to lose $1 million.
I don't think that's an accurate characterization. They were entitled to bid at the foreclosure sale if they wanted to recover their property. They chose not to do that. And by the way, they did not raise these anti-foreclosure issues at trial. In trial, they put all their eggs in the disclosure basket.
Well, wait, I thought they filed a TRO, motion for preliminary injunction, to stop the non-judicial foreclosure, which they said was not allowed.
Sure, and let me address that. In the First Amendment verified complaint, there were seven claims. Only two of them, fifth and seventh, were anti-foreclosure claims, were challenges to the foreclosure. Both of those claims were utterly meritless. They were dismissed under Rule 12b6 motion, and they were filed by the predecessor counsel. When the successor counsel came in their very first filing, their reply to the preliminary injunction motion, they acknowledged that both of those claims were meritless. The fifth claim was a claim for due process, which is precluded by the Ninth Circuit's APAO, APAO case. The seventh claim was a claim pursuant to HRS 667-42, which is Part 2, which their counsel acknowledged nobody in Hawaii ever uses that Part 2. So they filed only two claims challenging the foreclosure. Both of them were meritless, according to their counsel. Both were dismissed out early. And in the trial, they never challenged the nonjudicial foreclosure, the process. And in terms of equity, they never appealed to
What about your counterclaims? They challenged in your counterclaims the forfeiture. They said the forfeiture was didn't come. Not only wasn't there a provision, but there was a right to cure.
In their motion for reconsideration pursuant to Rule 59E after trial, after judgment. That's the first time they made that argument. The ICA was correct. The ICA said, look, you've made this argument for forfeiture after the horses had left the barn, after the trial was over, after judgment was entered. And their response was, back in trial, and I believe to the ICA was, we didn't know we were going to lose. Had we known that, yeah, we would have raised it. But, of course, you got to raise it.
How long did they have this after the sale?
I'm sorry?
How long did they own it from the time of the actual closing of the purchase until the nonjudicial foreclosure? How long? How much time passed?
From the Santiago's purchase of the property. The Santiago's purchase of the property closed in, I believe, August 2006. The foreclosure auction occurred in October 2008.
So 2 years later, they're out $1 million.
I don't agree with that characterization, Your Honor.
Did they pay your client $1 million?
They also were in the tavern for 3 years during the course of the litigation.
I have a question about that. Mr. Ahrensmeyer has estimated that you had argued that they were in there, that the rent would have been $328,161. Do you dispute that amount?
I'm sorry, Justin, I missed that. Say that again.
Mr. Ahrensmeyer has argued in response to your argument about they were on the property, that if they had been paying rent, it would have been worth $328,161. Do you dispute that amount?
I do dispute, but it's not what I dispute. The only testimony at trial on that point was Mr. Richardson, who went through the analysis, went through the rent calculations, and all of his testimony was received by the court, although his spreadsheet was not, but his testimony was, and he testified that there was still a deficiency judgment of $79,000, which the court did not grant to us, denied that, and ICA denied that as well. I should point out, Justice McKenna, we did not get everything we wanted. We didn't get a deficiency judgment, we didn't get damages, we didn't get nearly half our attorney's fees. But if I could, I know my time's running out, I'd love to address mootness for a moment if I could, because you're raising all sorts of interesting issues, but I think first you've got to deal with the matter of subject matter jurisdiction, which is mootness. And the ICA, I think, correctly found that Lathrop is controlling. It is moot. It was sold 8 months after.
Mr. Goldberg, I'm not sure you've answered the fundamental question, which is, if this is a proceeding that's supposed to have equitable considerations, how is it equitable to have an outcome where the Santiagos pay all of this money and don't get the property and don't get credit for the money they paid?
Because the nonjudicial for
and the answer I'm hearing from you is they should have raised it at the trial and they didn't raise it at the trial. Do you have anything other than that argument?
Yes, that's the procedural aspect. The substantive aspect is the statute provides for nonjudicial foreclosure. I mean, whether the result is positive or negative, that's provided by statute. And we followed all the requirements of the nonjudicial foreclosure. It's a transparent process. Let me make clear, this wasn't done in the dead of night with no transparency. It was a public process with advertisement itself, and it's under judicial supervision. Even though I understand it was not a judicial foreclosure, we're in court in this case dealing with all these issues. So I don't think there's an equity problem when there's a public auction. Anyone can show up and bid. The Santiagos could have and should have shown up and bid because anything they bid more than the note amount, all the money would go back to them and they'd keep their property. They chose not to bid. We tried to ask.
So they should have bid more than $500,000. I see. Basically, you're saying that they should have just come in and paid off the note.
We certainly asked them to pay off the note and prevent the foreclosure, right? Many times.
How many years was this note supposed to be?
You know, off the top of my head, I'm not positive, but for some, I don't want to answer. I can find out pretty quickly.
That's okay. We can check.
Exhibit D1 is the promissory note, and I don't want to give a wrong answer because I'm not positive.
The promissory note, if I remember right, doesn't it say that a person has to doesn't, the way it's worded, right, it says, and if any event of default shall occur and be continued. That's what it says.
By the way, that's a five-year note, Justice.
You know, I don't understand your answer to this CJ's question, excuse me, the Chief Justice's question. He asked you about an equitable remedy, and you went back to the law. And so, and also to Justice McKenna, where he was asking about how is this equitable, not going back to the statute.
Okay, but certainly that those are issues that were addressed and considered by Judge Watanabe in the circuit court.
I'm asking you now. I think our question is not about what Judge Watanabe did. What is your response now to us? If we're not asking for a legal justification, equitable justification.
I say under these circumstances, there's nothing inequitable about going through the non-judicial foreclosure process, given the Santiago's two lawsuits against Mrs. Tanaka, their continued occupancy of the premises, and the transparent
they
process.
They were paying the entire time, of course.
They did pay the entire time, that's right. May I address mootness, Your Honor?
You may.
Sure. The mootness is a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, and that's why the ICA didn't address many of these foreclosure issues, because based on Lathrop versus Sacatani, the key point I want to point out is that we filed a motion to expunge the NOPA, or list pendants, after judgment. They filed a statement of no opposition in response to the motion to expunge the NOPA, and they didn't appear at the hearing, so the NOPA was granted. Excuse me, the NOPA was expunged without any opposition. The NOPA is the procedural mechanism to prevent the sale of the property to a bona fide purchaser to moot the controversy. And they chose not to oppose that. They didn't appeal that decision. They didn't seek a stay or an injunction with respect to the expungement of the NOPA. And the property was sold to a bona fide purchaser 8 months later. So it's not like she turned around the next day and sold it to her brother-in-law. We did submit a declaration with all the escrow documents, including the deed. The only possible way...
You know what else is attached to that, which is very interesting? I was just taking a look at it. I don't know if it's in the record, and I'm surprised that you attached it, because you know what? It discloses the Jasper fees. It shows the pro rata. It shows every single thing that should have been there from the beginning.
But we certainly provided all the escrow documents. We weren't going to hide anything from anybody. If the reason is that Tanaka's learned from this whole 8 years of litigation experience, maybe that accounts for it. But
what do you mean escrow documents? What do you mean by escrow documents? You provided all
the new up to the new buyer.
You provided all the escrow documents. What do you mean?
We submitted to the ICA the escrow documents to show that the property had been sold to a new purchaser, a bona fide purchaser.
And in escrow, the second escrow, the Jasper sewer fees were in the second escrow.
That's what Justice Fogg is saying. I hadn't latched on to that. Because our only point was that this property's been sold, and Lathrop says you can't undo the closing. They have not disputed that it's been sold. They have not disputed that it's a bona fide purchaser.
Did you just say that it's to her brother-in-law? Or was that
No, I'm saying facetiously, she didn't sell it the next day to her brother-in-law. She sold it 8 months later to an arm's length transaction to a person totally unconnected to her, and that's never been disputed. And that's what the ICA found. And that's why it's moot. The property was sold over 3 years ago.
Was there a finding on that, or was that just presented to the ICA? Was that presented below at the trial court?
It could not have been presented below because the sale happened in May 1, 2012 when we were already pending appeal. And that's what happened in Lathrop. In Lathrop, there was a sale pending appeal, and the only possible way to present that information to the appellate court is to present that information to the appellate court. And because it's a matter of subject matter jurisdiction.
Who is a purchaser?
I couldn't even tell you the guy's name. But the only way to raise it with the ICA is to submit it during the pendency appeal. It's not a matter of enlarging the record on appeal. We're not asking them. The ICA to review that in connection with the findings of fact or the conclusion of law. It's raising a matter of subject matter jurisdiction, which of course we can raise at any time. I mean, if circumstances change, if a party died or a business went bankrupt or dissolved, whatever, you present that information to the Court of Appeals, and there's no dispute that it's been sold to a
subject matter jurisdiction.
Yeah. The ICA cited Hamilton Garner Wong that mootness is definitely a matter of subject matter jurisdiction. And I'm very sorry, I didn't see my light went on.
We do have a few more. At least I have a question, and then I'll allow you to wrap up briefly. Is it your position that there's no right to cure a default under HRS 667-5?
Definitely not. And I'm glad you mentioned that because I do want to point out they cite the 667-5C, which didn't exist at the time this default was noticed and foreclosure initiated.
It existed at the time of the foreclosure sale.
Of the auction. But Section 7 of Act 138 says it takes effect on the approval date, which is June 3, and Section 5 says it's not retroactive. It does not apply to rights that accrued or proceedings that were begun before the effective date. So subsection C is not part of this. But to answer the question, subsection C does not create a right, statutory right to cure. It's a provide information statute. It says at the request of an interested party, you will provide information about interest, late fees, penalties, etc. In this case, no request was ever made. They've never pointed to a
doesn't
request.
That imply if some of the disclosures relate to amounts necessary to cure, doesn't that imply a right to cure?
If there was a right to cure contained in the mortgage document. For example, in the Lee versus HSBC case, that's exactly what happened. The mortgage provided a 30-day right to cure.
So the document trumps the statute. That's your argument?
No. If the document provides a right to cure, the statute says they have to provide information on request. The statute doesn't create a right to cure. There's nothing in that statute that creates a right to cure. All it says is that upon request, you will provide certain information. That's all it says.
And I'm looking at the findings of fact, and the trial court explicitly found in its findings of fact that it rejected the right to cure argument. So how could the ICA find that this argument was somehow waived? It's right there in the findings of fact.
No, I believe with respect to right to cure, the ICA found that was part of the mootness subject matter jurisdiction problem.
Mootness because the property was sold?
I think that's why the ICA didn't address, I don't believe, address the right to cure argument on its merits. And I think the reason for that is because of mootness.
Would it not be relevant to, even if you can't unscramble the transaction and bring the property back, wouldn't it be relevant to what the amount or what judgment should be entered in this case, what the appropriate judgment is? If they had a right to cure and that right was denied, wouldn't that be a grounds for rejecting the counterclaim?
If there was a right to cure, I certainly don't agree there's a right to cure. And I understand what you're saying. Would that get around the mootness problem? It might. But I want to be real firm on that 667-5 pre-subsection C and post-subsection C does not provide a right to cure.
Okay, let's assume that our law says that foreclosure is an equitable remedy. Let's assume that includes a right to cure. What do you think the remedy would be?
In this case?
Yes.
Assuming the property's been sold and
that the right to cure had, first of all, let's assume that there was a power of sale.
Okay.
That's another assumption. But assuming that there was a power of sale and assuming there was a right to cure, what do you think the remedy should be under these circumstances?
A remand down to the circuit court to address that issue.
For damages?
Potentially. But I think the circuit court in the first instance should take a look at the issue and decide if there's a need for some sort of equitable right to cure in this case.
I'm sorry. Let's just assume that our law says that foreclosure is an equitable remedy.
That
just a matter of equity, as a matter of law, includes a reasonable right to cure, right? Because if we follow your argument, any time if there was no right to cure in the mortgage, your argument is that any time anyone is late, the next day, it can just be accelerated, and I'm sorry, you're out. You've got to pay it off.
But I think the equitable considerations in this case do not militate in the direction.
Because the payments were made 1 month later.
It's not just that.
Mm-hmm.
They were hit with three lawsuits. We haven't even talked about the third one, but that's not before this court. But in this context, yeah, I don't think equity militates in favor of the signers. I think equity militates in favor of the signers.
I had asked you that question a long time ago, so we're getting to the answer now.
Okay.
So tell us why equity militates in favor of the Tanakas.
Because, number one, I think we prevailed.
So three lawsuits. The fact that there were lawsuits.
That's a big one.
Okay.
That's a big one. She was hit with three lawsuits. And from our perspective, we're 100% right on the disclosure. And that was at least that's what the circuit court found, and that's what the ICA found unanimously. So from our perspective,
there's some sense that it was frivolous, the litigation was frivolous. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, but part of it, but I don't think that's a requirement. But certainly the circuit court could look at the situation, look at all the facts, look at what happened between the Santiago's and Mrs. Tanaka and say, this is not a situation where equity is going to intervene. I agree with Justice McKenna. In an appropriate case where someone just misses one payment inadvertently and their equity could step in and avoid that kind of inequitable result. I don't think this is the case.
You wouldn't allow anybody to step in this case. Soon as that next day happened, that was it.
But let me point out just about, if it were the case that there's an automatic right to cure, meaning that anyone can always go back to monthly payments at any time before foreclosure, think what that would mean as a practical matter. Anytime there's a foreclosure, person could simply come current before the auction, end the foreclosure case completely, and we start all over with a new foreclosure case. It's an endless cycle of foreclosure cases.
But in this case, it was within 5 days. Is that right?
I don't think that's the case in the record, because from our perspective, and again, this is Mr. Richardson's testimony.
I know if you're talking about accelerating the whole note thing, that's a different.
That's right.
Okay, but aside from the accelerating the whole note theory, did they come current on their payments within 5 days? Aside from the theory,
I don't think that's an accurate reading of the record, Your Honor.
What didn't they do? How far behind were they?
They, from our perspective, they.
I thought they sent all the money in, and then they were $19 short, so they sent another check in for that remainder, something like. And if I'm wrong, please correct.
Yeah, you may not be far off, but I don't agree with the characterization that this was just a 5-day snafu. I think this is a case where we're told all payments are being halted due to litigation.
And put into an account, meaning that that money is readily available.
And I don't know that ever happened.
There was no disputed testimony about that at trial, that's what the note says.
And we have no way of knowing that, but even still, there's no right for the borrower to escrow payments. Mm-hmm. I certainly can't do that with the Bank
of
Hawaii.
He paid a lot for that. He paid attorney fees, he paid penalties, he paid all kinds of things.
And Mrs. Tanaka has paid a lot in 8 years of litigation in 3 lawsuits.
Didn't she recover a lot of the attorney's fees?
We got an award for $152,000. To date, we haven't collected a penny.
They already paid some attorney's fees. Now, this is the $150 for this one, but I haven't. In order to cure, you demanded that they pay attorney's fees, and they did not cure.
They did pay some attorney's fees.
Current, but they did pay attorney's fees.
Right, and we've always taken the position that if they want to pay off the note, great, there's no foreclosure, but we're not returning to monthly payments. Because it's important to understand the context a little bit. I mean, Mrs. Tanaka, her maiden name is Kubiyama, and this wasn't.
Is it in the record? Are you going to tell us?
Yeah, this is in the record. Mr. Tanaka testified, her maiden name is Kubiyama. This property was formerly the Kubiyama Hotel. It was in the family for 70 years. And it was a difficult emotional decision, but they finally decided to sell the property because it was being operated as a bar by the Sonics, and they just didn't want any legal headaches, didn't want any lawsuits. And here we are 8 years later.
Interesting, because you could have avoided the lawsuit readily.
Anything else you want to wrap up? If you want to briefly discuss the power of sale, you can.
I thought I should spend 1 minute on that.
All right, and then we'll move on.
Sure. Page 6 of the mortgage provides 2 options. It's 1 or 2. It doesn't have the numbers 1 or 2. It says judicial proceeding or the disjunctive or advertisement and sale at a public auction. I think this idea that by putting in as now or then provided by law, as somehow that eviscerates the words by advertisement and sale at a public auction does not make sense. It simply means that to the extent Hawaii law allows non-judicial foreclosures, which it does, then we'd have to comply with all the requirements. If Hawaii law did not allow non-judicial foreclosures, and I guess some states don't, then putting that power in there wouldn't have any effect anyway. But it had the power in there. It says, of course, it's subject to Hawaii law. We complied with Hawaii law. I should just point out that they've never contended that we didn't comply with the statutory prerequisites. They never contended that the price paid at the auction was unreasonable. They didn't challenge the foreclosure at trial. Their entire defense, which the ICA says, was disclosure. And when they lost on that, they lost on everything. There were no anti-foreclosure claims left in the lawsuit. When they moved for a preliminary injunction at the beginning of the case, and there was no remaining claims for injunctive relief, it was just damages claims, Judge Watanabe said, preliminary to what? There's no request for injunctive relief to stop the foreclosure. There was no basis to stop the foreclosure. They weren't seeking to stop the foreclosure. It was a damages case. And their sole defense to our counterclaim at trial was disclosure. And we prevailed on disclosure. And perhaps I haven't had enough time to go through the disclosure documents, but if the court looks at the findings of fact and the disclosure documents and the ICA's opinion, it wasn't a close call. 4 judges have looked at it, and 4 judges have found that disclosure was abundant. And so we don't view that as a close call.
Anything else to wrap up?
Sorry for going over. Thank you.
No, thank you very much, Mr. Goldberg. Now we'll hear from Mr. Arnsmeyer in rebuttal.
briefly, I'd like to correct a few points that were raised by Mr. Goldberg. First of all, he claims that Mrs. Tanaka was hit with three lawsuits. Mrs. Tanaka was originally sued over non-disclosure of the wastewater agreement. That case was dismissed. The parties attempted to engage in mediation. Only after this foreclosure was noticed was a second lawsuit then filed. And as for a third lawsuit, I'm not sure what Mr. Goldberg is referring to. He may be referring to a lawsuit that happened after this case when Mrs. Tanaka, in fact, sued the Santiagos, claiming that they were somehow liable to her for sewer fees going forward after she recovered the property. We prevailed in that lawsuit. Tanaka appealed. We prevailed on appeal. So as far as equity, three lawsuits, Justice Pollack is right. This was avoidable. Finally, with respect to counsel's representation that in the Lathrop case there was a motion or somehow evidence presented on appeal of a third-party sale, that's simply not the case. Footnote 9 of this court's opinion in Lathrop, in fact, confirms that when this court rejected the petitioner's attempt to present new evidence on appeal. This case is not moot. There's certainly remedies available. Remedies exist in the form of title and possession if, in fact, this third-party buyer is not a bona fide purchaser for value.
So, well, you haven't raised that before, have you? That the third-party buyer is not a bona fide purchaser.
Your Honor, that issue has never been brought in the proper form.
So if that's not before us today, what would your remedy be?
On remand, the remedy would be a quiet title claim against this new buyer if, in fact, it was discovered that he took this property not in good faith or with notice of the Santiago's claim, their existing appeal. Even if that remedy is not available, the remedy of damages or offset, returning some of that money that the Santiago's were inequitably deprived of, that's an available remedy. And at the very least, if the Santiago's prevail on any of these issues on appeal, that award of attorney's fees to Tanaka of $152,000 as the prevailing party in an action in the nature of a sumpsit, there's relief available in having that reversed and set aside. For those reasons, I thank the court for granting our petition, and I would request that it overturn the ICA and remand this case to the circuit court.
Very well. Thank you to both of our attorneys today for your arguments, and the court will take this matter under advisement.
Thank you.